Today, the kids step up to the microphone, and the kids just happen to be independent film stars. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, February 25th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the stars and creators of the new feature film, Jazzy. Produced by Oscar-nominated Lily Gladstone, directed by South Dakota filmmaker Marissa Maltz, and starring Spearfish and Pine Ridge actors. It's a meditative look at friendship and childhood, especially those days in childhood you don't really want to end. Plus, what does it mean to have a compassionate classroom? Teacher Talk explores the tenets of self-compassion. We'll discuss the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion, and how to talk to yourself as you would a dear friend. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota filmmaker Marissa Maltz released a new feature film this month. Jazzy features the young South Dakota talent of Jasmine Bearkiller Shangru and her friend Soraya Foolhead Means. Executive producers on the film include Oscar-nominated Lily Gladstone. The movie is a coming-of-age tale of friendship and independence set over the course of 6 years. Jasmine Bearkiller Shangru and Soraya Foolhead Means join me in the SDPB Sue W. White studio in Spearfish, that's on the campus of Black Hills State University. So I have watched a movie where you're acting, but I also came away with the idea that you were also very good friends. Soraya, are you really good friends in real life too?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you two know each other and the kinds of things you do together as friends in real life.
We met when we were really little because our moms were friends. And we just kind of, like, hang out together.
Jazzy, tell me, do you remember meeting Soraya when you were little?
No, I can only remember, like, certain things we've done together when we were, like, 5 or 6.
Yeah. So how did you end up making a movie together? Tell me that story, Jasmine.
So when Marissa was filming The Unknown Country, she had a lot of like clips of me and stuff, and she thought that I would be really good to make a movie about as well. So she used those old clips of me that she used from Unknown Country, and she put them in with a Jazzy movie, and then we continued recording on from when I was in like 5th grade.
Wow. And do you see her, Marissa, often? Do you spend time with her like in your regular life?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're talking with her, if you have a nail date or get ice cream together, are you talking about making movies?
Well, this was like when we were filming, I would basically tell her certain stuff I've done, or like things that happened to me or other people in school, and she would put that into like the movie and stuff for us, ideas and like certain things from the movie. But now we just kind of talk about whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Soraya, making the movie and having the cameras there as you play and goof around and even get in a fight, how was that for you to experience? What was it like for you?
It was kind of hard for us because it was hard for us to stay mad at each other. So when we were supposed to be like mad at each other, we just kept laughing.
This is one of the great things about this movie, is that it is about friendship. And when there's an unfriending, Soraya is just not talking to Jasmine in the film, it's hard to watch. I was worried for you. When you watch the movie, Soraya, do you feel that when you watch it, that worry of losing a friend?
Kinda.
Yeah. Has that ever happened to you in real life? Or happened to someone that you know?
Yeah, I lost a friend before.
Yeah. And it hurts for a long time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jasmine, one of the things in this film is that the friendship is in trouble because of the adults. It's nothing that's happening between the kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk to Marissa about this a little bit too, but what was it like for you to be such the focus of this movie, especially compared to Unknown Country, which is really about the adults? This movie is about the kids in the room.
It was really different because in the Unknown Country, I was like only there as a background character, and it wasn't anything that important, but it was really fun. But in the Jazzy movie, I had a lot more responsibilities and harder things to do. But because I was younger then, so now that I'm older, I like understand it fully now. So I guess I was like in the age where I could actually do it than I was when I was like 6 years old or 7 years old.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't really been able to do it. But
yeah,
it was like harder, but it was also fun.
Soraya, was there a scene that you had a lot of fun? Was there a part that was fun to make?
Probably when we were playing the clarinets, because I don't know, it was just fun.
What do your friends think of the show, of the film?
From comments I get from not even friends sometimes, but like other people and friends, everybody who watched it, mm-hmm. so far they came up to me and said it was really good.
Yeah, I think it's beautifully done. I think that you're both really good actors, for starters. And I really enjoy it. Like, it made my day. So it made me, I cried, I laughed. I felt like you were my friends. And Jazzy, you get to spend more time with Lily Gladstone now. Is she helping you, learn how to be in the movies a little bit? What was it like working with her the second time?
It was really fun because not only that she was like a really nice person, but she's also a really good actor. So I think watching her movies could really help me improve on acting.
Yeah.
And also it kind of shows that fame and like popularity doesn't matter. It just matters how you are personally. And I'm glad she's a really good person outside of acting and outside of her popularity and fame.
Yeah. Soraya, there aren't too many movies that have Lakota language in it that would feature Spearfish or Pine Ridge or the Booth Hatchery where the fish are. This is a big deal to have a movie about the place that we live that the rest of the world can see. What do you think of that?
It's really cool to share like my culture with like other people who never saw it. And yeah, it's just like a really beautiful language and culture and stuff.
Yeah. And your doodles are in the end credits.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you guys want to do next? Do you want to make more movies? Do you want to... A lot of this movie is about maybe not wanting to grow up. But what do you want to do now? Do you want to make more movies at your age? How has this sort of affected you, Jazzy?
I'm thinking about acting more, but mm-hmm. I'm just going to see how life turns out, and I'll think more about what I want to do when I'm older.
Yeah. Soraya, how about you?
I don't really want to do acting because I'm really shy. But when I grow up, I want to do something like with pets, like take care of them.
Yeah, nice. Do you get to keep anything from the movie? Any props or costumes? Or do you have anything to remember the experience by?
Well, like the shirts that Lily gave me in the end, I still have those.
Nice.
And I feel like the only gift that we get to keep to ourselves was just filming in general.
Yeah.
Because it was really fun. And I really like thinking back to when we acted and like the good times.
Yeah.
I made like the whole cast that was at the movie theater last night. I made them like sign a little poster.
Nice.
And now it's hanging up in my bedroom.
Nice. It's really special. Thank you for making this movie so people like me can watch it and experience it. I really appreciate it. It feels like you've given me a present. It didn't occur to me when I watched Unknown Country that this could be a cinematic place of its own, that there would be a continuation of a storyline or characters. And I don't know why I didn't think that. I guess I thought Unknown Country was just so special that nothing...
I didn't think of it either, to tell you the truth, so how I'm with
it,
you.
How did it come about that you said, you know what, I think we can stay in this visual language and stay in this community and we can do more? Where'd that come from for you?
I mean, it really came out of the love that I developed within, you know, that community. I got incredibly close to Jazzy and her family, and I don't have kids yet, and I don't have nieces and nephews. I'm an only child, so I got really close to Jazzy. Yeah. You know, we live close to each other when we're here in South Dakota, so I just developed a bond that sort of, it was just organic, that interest was there. And as we were sort of finishing up the Unknown Country, as Jazzy was saying before, like, we had this footage of Jazzy, and Jazzy was so great in those moments, and she so clearly wanted to keep doing it, that it just felt like a natural progression to be like, oh, could we just make another film about Jazzy? Yeah. So it really grew out of, like, that love that was developed between all of us making The Unknown Country.
In so many ways, it feels like Jazzy and Soraya made the film. And I mean that as a very high compliment.
No, that's the best compliment. Okay. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It feels like they got together and said, let's make a movie about our lives. Let's go get Marissa to, you know, show us the things that we don't know how to do. And that's how it comes across on the screen. Talk a little bit about getting that dialogue from real life and how kids talk to a script and then back to a performance on camera.
Oh, I love that. That really is, like, the greatest compliment, because that was the idea sort of behind it, was to have them really create it, and, you know, be able to pull off this, you know, a lot of coming to age movies, they end up being about the parents more than they are about the kids in a lot of ways, or they kind of feel, we just wanted this to be sort of about the kids, created by the kids. And I felt like, you know, because I'm not, you know, Jazzy and I kind of have almost this, I don't know how to describe it, but it's this almost like adult relationship, even when she was younger, where she would come and confide in me and tell me these things that happened at school. And I was like, oh, like, these are amazing scenes. Like, we really collaborated on it from when she was younger. Like, even Landon's whole character of, like, the girlfriend's bit was something Jazzy told me that was happening on the playground and something that boys were doing. And, like, that whole character kind of grew out of Jazzy's stories. So
I have a whole bunch of girlfriends. Actually, no, I don't. I've asked girls out many times, but no, really, I actually never have. So
You know, I really wanted the kids to have that freedom, and I mean, I can't believe we pulled it off, but that's why that's such a great compliment in so many ways.
Another thing that I noticed and I loved about The Unknown Country is your pacing and the way that you handle, your team handles editing. But one of my memories of childhood, which this really brought up for me, the film did, was how much time you have by yourself, just in your room, on the playground, walking, on the bus, you know, there's these huge swaths of internal, just hanging out with yourself and figuring out, what is my favorite animal? What is my favorite? Who am I? What am I afraid of? What do I like? And I thought you visually captured that internal landscape in this really pretty and not scary and not nostalgic, but expansive way.
Thank
I can't
you,
explain
Lauren.
It because it's visual language. It doesn't.
Thank
it, you.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like giving that time.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of, that time to let things play out, to feel moments. You know, so much of life, I feel like, is in the subtle, quiet moments. And just like you said, like, I remember what it felt like to be a kid. I think back to that time often, and just those, how everything felt very grand, but also quite boring. But, like, you know, this sort of, and just the sense of time passing, and we really tried to have those feelings in the film. And, you know, and again, like, Jazzy and Soraya brought that. Like, we would just kind of, like, you know, put the camera there, let them do whatever, and sometimes moments pass for 10 minutes, and our editors are actually nominated for Independent Spirit Award,
which
is a big deal, because for a tiny micro-budget film like this, they're, like, up against huge films. So I'm really proud of that for
them. Yeah, just play with your stuffed animals, you know? That's an example of, like, well, when you're alone in your room by yourself, how do you play with your stuffed animals? And, you know, we get to see that play out on the screen.
Totally. I just love, you know, so many films are about, like, there's, like, you know, a few big moments in your life where your life really changes, and, like, many films are about that. But I love that these films are about kind of all the moments in between.
Yeah.
And, yeah, just that kind of feeling of just all the tiny things I love.
And this melancholy, maybe, about an awareness of not wanting to grow up, not wanting a friendship to end, not wanting a friend to move away. Not wanting to have to get a job. Just the things about being a kid that you're like, oh, there's an awareness that this is good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that I remember quite deeply from growing up. Like, I loved childhood, and I loved that imaginary sense and just everything about it. And, you know, I think a lot of creative people tend to just be kids themselves that didn't want to grow up in so many ways.
Yeah.
I remember that fear and just that idea that I couldn't stop it from happening. And, you know, and I think that's something with the kids that we also talked about a lot, of just like, of just sort of the what's next and not wanting it to be that. And I think that came quite naturally to Jazzy and Soraya, just sort of addressing that.
How do we be friends forever?
Yeah. And like that whole bit that like Jazzy does on the trampoline of like not wanting to grow up, you know, like we talked about her not wanting to grow up, and then she just made that up on the spot.
Really?
And that's and that's one of my favorite parts of the
whole
film.
Monologue about
she literally made that up.
Here's the reason why you shouldn't grow up. When you grow up, you're going to have to go to work. And when you go to work, you'll be tired. And when you're tired, you'll go home. And then your boss will be mad at you, and then you'll lose your job. That was spontaneous.
Oh, that whole bit, she made that up in it was one take. Like, we had talked about the idea of not wanting to grow up, and then she just did that bit.
I am so impressed. Yeah, growing up sounds ugly. Let's not talk about that anymore.
they got it, you know? I love them so much. They really did such an incredible job.
So how did you come into the space? Because you are forever going to be part of these children's stories. You're a character in their story forever, and you want to be a nice one, right? I mean, they're going to look back at this movie. You don't want to be like the lady who made them do something that they didn't want to do.
Oh, our lives are very entwined.
How did you show up and just say, okay, I want to make a great movie, and I also have to be a good adult?
I think the good adult part is very minimal. I think that, you know, they're both taller than me. Yeah, and they, you know, they come over to my house and we draw, and I have a studio where I do art stuff, and like I think the idea that I'm actually an adult is like far-fetched.
Got it.
I think, you know, so I mean, I remember the very first day that Soraya, we were like connecting and on the bus, that first scene in the film, and she was like, oh, I love your sweatshirt and all the bugs on it. And, like, that's such a pretty, like, pink, like, hat. Like, just, like, even the clothes I was wearing.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, this is just, like, a child that, like, is somehow in control
right
of the situation.
Yeah,
so I think that, like, did build a lot of, like, the trust. And it is true. Like, I honestly feel more comfortable hanging out with 12 and 13-year-olds than I do feel hanging out with adults. So it's also genuine. Like, I genuinely love hanging out with them, and
me too. I got to hang out with them in the movie, and I genuinely loved it. So to answer the question, like, how do you stay a kid forever? The answer is be an artist.
Unfortunately, yes. I think it's actually true. I mean, I talk about that with a lot of my creative friends.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's so much, like, it's such a gift to be able to be doing this, you know, doing what we love. And it was it's also a way to to stay a kid, we play pretend. We, you know, get to make up stories and, and yeah, it really, there's a, truly that is something that is very much shared with my, within my circle of people that I work with.
Yeah. Bringing these, and I asked Jasmine this and Soraya this, just these stories from Pine Ridge, from Spearfish, from the landscape of childhood to the rest of the world, and Lily Gladstone's impact on that, and just what it means to make these movies from this place. That means so much to me. What does it mean to you?
You know, I think like what I was saying before, just falling so in love with Jazzy and her family and creating these films together, like all happened so organically. And I'm not originally from South Dakota, so you know, coming here and spending more and more time here and, you know, living here more over the last few years, like it's grown to be something that I'm so happy and proud to have been able to do with Jazzy's family, you know, like that whole scene at the end of the movie, the funeral scene, all of that stuff, like they created all of that and got all of that together and got their family together, and we filmed it on Jazzy's grandmother's land, and you know, being able to do all that just feels so special. And and Lily has been such an incredible, like, as I can't put it in better words than what Jazzy said earlier, but like basically what Jazzy was saying, like Lily's just such a good person, and she has such a big heart, and her wanting to continue sharing these types of stories and supporting these smaller films that really are able to do things that bigger films aren't able to do, sharing important stories and in small places, that's important to her and it's important to me, and I'm just glad that we're able to sort of have built all this together.
And everyone, everybody in that project has learned something about making film, and you don't know what other projects are to come from this and how, you know.
Absolutely.
Artistically, musically.
Absolutely. And you know, like Soraya, Soraya was saying earlier that she wants to work with pets, which is very sweet. But she's also like such a creative. She's incredibly creative. She's always photographing and singing, and they're so incredible in the film, and they're so talented in general.
Thank you.
That's Marissa Maltz, filmmaker and director of Jazzy. You can find Jazzy on Apple TV. They're also planning a showing at the theater in Kyle, South Dakota in the future. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, it is that time of year when people in the education field can start feeling a bit worn out. Jackie Wilbur's solution each year around this time is to practice self-compassion. So let's turn now to our Teacher Talk educators for tips on how to create compassionate classrooms that start with self-compassion for teachers. And here's a hot tip. It might be good for the office and for families too. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public schools in 2007 and has served as a middle and high school teacher and a public librarian. She's an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. She's the recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. Let's start with Dr. Wilbur.
I think this time of year, always we touch base about how, I don't know, you sometimes you go to work when it's dark, you leave when it's dark. It can feel a long way till the end of the school year, and you could start to feel like maybe you need a little levity, a little lift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. February is hard for me. I'm not going to lie. February is my difficult month.
You know, January and February for me.
Yeah, I can usually get good through January because you're kind of coming down from the excitement of the holidays and the new year, and I'm like, okay, whew.
Mm-hmm. Excitement's mm-hmm. over. I can rest a little bit. And then January hits and I'm like, ooh, mm-hmm. where's the sun?
Yeah. I relate to that.
It's hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So cold. So we're going to go back and talk a little bit about compassion. Jackie, where do you want to kick this off with?
Well, I will say it is partially inspired by Valentine's Day because there is an article in the New York Times that I read every year that first came out in 2019 that is called "For Valentine's Day, Try Being Nice to Yourself," which I think is a great concept for Valentine's Day and a great concept in general year round. But one of the researchers that is cited in that article is Kristen Neff, and she's someone that I've been studying for a while. The first time I read this article in 2019, I was reading a lot of Kristen Neff. She's a self-compassion researcher, and a lot of the work I did in my doctoral dissertation was related to self-compassion. And so I was really immersed in her work at the time, and the article came out at just the right moment, and I've been using that research ever since as a way of relating to myself and relating to students and talking about classrooms in general.
Why was your dissertation about self-compassion?
Maybe we should write, I'll write another blog post about my doctoral dissertation sometime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But can I read it?
Yes, of course you can. Yeah. Happy to send that your way. I think you're the only one who's ever asked to read my doctoral dissertation.
Jackie!
I stand corrected. You two are the only two.
We have a reading group now, and probably third book we've read together is going to be Jackie Wilbur's dissertation. There it is.
Very flattering. I appreciate it. Thank you. But the short version is that my dissertation was about growth mindset in students and how relaxation practices interfaced with growth mindset. And the relaxation practices that I was looking at were rooted in a philosophy that had self-compassion as the first tenet to being able to practice relaxation.
Okay, what is it?
What is self-compassion?
Yeah.
So I say this in the blog. I think it's easier to explain self-compassion by first starting with the definition of compassion.
Okay.
I like Brené Brown, as always. I always like Brené Brown definitions. But she says that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that compassion is a non-judgmental desire to help a fellow human being. Say, I see you as a human. I would like to help you. I am not judging the situation you're in. I see your situation is very human, and I'm here to help.
Yeah. A relationship between equals.
I really like that part.
Yeah,
it is not a savior mentality. It is just, I am here as an equal to support you during this difficult time.
As a human being,
And then self-compassion just simply is turning that compassion onto yourself. So rather than judging oneself during a hard time, you say, I'm here to support myself in this time of difficulty. I'm not judging my situation. I see it as a human situation, and I'm here to help myself because I care about me as a person.
I like that.
I like that, too. And I'm glad for this reminder, because especially in these cold months where we live, my body wants to hibernate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to get off the couch. It's hard to do some of the work that would be easier to do in the warmer months. And I beat myself up sometimes. I judge myself because why am I being so lazy? And maybe I need to succumb to the rhythm of the seasons and rest.
So let's talk about that, because I went back and watched Kristen Neff's TED Talk again and took two pages of notes because I thought that would be good for me. And I'm very happy I did it, because she talks about that self-critic.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie, I love that the research bears out what intuitively we want, which is that kindness is actually more effective than cruelty. But let's talk a little bit about the self-critic and how hard we are on ourselves, and the fact that we think we're not just bad people who are mean to ourselves. We have internalized somehow the story that the only way to motivate yourself to get off the couch is to say, hey, dummy, hey, lazy, get up, do something. And that isn't actually supported by the research.
Yeah, it's not what's being best
effective.
For us.
That's not what was actually best for you. Mm-hmm. Jackie Wilbur, why not? Why is it when it seems like it's working and it seems like that's how we were maybe even taught to talk to ourselves, and if everybody was kind to us, we still end up talking to ourselves like that. Why do we think it works?
Yeah, such a good question. I mean, it's It's multi-layered, as Kristen Neff's TED Talk will articulate better than I do. But certainly, it's cultural. Like, it is very cultural, yeah, specifically in the United States, arguably even more so in the Midwest, that we are conditioned to think that we need to be critical of ourselves in order to be successful. It's part of our cultural way of going. Mm. And the reason that is not true is that criticism creates a state of stress. And so very briefly, the state of stress is referred to as the sympathetic nervous response. It's the physiological response that we naturally have and should have in actual states of stress. I'm walking along in a forest. I see a bear. It is to my survival best instinct to go into a state of stress so that I react based on my instincts and can either run away really quickly or freeze and hide and survive that situation. But criticism creates that same physiological response when there isn't a thing that needs to be survived, right? Mm-hmm. A mistake is not a bear, but we're responding as though it is, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is where the issues occur, because the opposite side of that, a compassionate side, is the rest and digest stage, or the state of relaxation when your parasympathetic nervous system is turned on. Yeah. And so that is the state of higher level thinking, of creativity, of being in relationship and a feeling of warmth and coziness and well-being, as Kristen Neff talks about in the TED Talk. And those are the spaces where you actually have more room to troubleshoot, more room to think about how you might improve the situation and work through the mistake. So when you're critical with yourself, you're actually narrowing your choices. You're shutting down in a lot of ways and responding based on instincts as though you're in a survival situation. And those are not going to yield your best results for working through the problem.
Yeah. So think if that's been working for you, think how much better it would be working for you if you obeyed the research and were able to sit in curiosity and active problem solving for, you know, what to do in the winter, what to do about the fact that you don't want to get off the couch in the winter.
Yeah, just sit with yourself in silence, stare out the window,
yeah,
and rest, and just be open to all the ideas that could come.
I love what she says in her TED Talk about the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion. And self-esteem, she says, is this global judgment of self-worth, where you're always saying, am I a good person or a bad person? And it has a lot to do with comparison, which creates narcissism, bullying, antisocial behavior, aggressive behavior to other people, or othering. Because now all of a sudden, if your definition of your own worth is based on whether you're better than someone else, then you will intuitively do a lot of things to either drive yourself or to knock people off their pedestal so they look a little bit less than you. And the whole bunch of bad behavior comes from self-esteem gotten through ill means.
Being so critical of yourself. When I did a little studying of narcissism, narcissists act like they are that, like, they totally believe in themselves and have all the confidence in the world, and it's actually the opposite. That's what the outward appearance is, but on the inside, so critical of themselves.
Yeah, and that can be whether how you look, how far you can run, how you perform at work, how much money you have in the bank, and then any obstacle really throws that off.
Yeah,
you get any kind of glitch. Pandemic, anyone?
Right.
Well, also when you're trying to control so much, and you can really only control yourself, right? Like, if you're getting your self-worth from your children, that's a big problem.
Then they grow up and, I've struggled with that.
I think it's natural.
Yeah. You got a kid, you're like, well, that's what I'm here for. Yeah. And look at me, I'm a good mother. And they're for a good person. And then they move to New York and you're like, oh, well, nobody realizes what a good mother I am anymore.
So now who am I?
So now what? Yeah. So now what do I do next?
Yeah.
But, well, thinking about it from a classroom perspective, too, it requires all of this external validation, right?
Yeah.
And so in order for students to have self-esteem, they need this constant reinforcement that they're doing well.
Yeah.
And as Dr. Neff says in the TED Talk, it also requires you to be unique and exceptional. Well, that's not possible for everyone in the classroom to be unique and exceptional. Now everyone's the same again, right? Like, if everyone is getting these like, oh, you're the best
trophy.
One.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. Awards, they yeah. can quickly deduce that everyone has received that. And so it doesn't yeah. boost their self-esteem. Self-compassion, on the other hand, though, doesn't make any judgment. It's like that's inherent in the definition. There's no judgment there. This is just I am a human and this is the experience that I'm going through.
Yeah. Oh, I read something earlier today that just remind me, you're going to love this quote. I got to find it for a minute here. But this idea of what you just said about being human and how often we overlook our common humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about books.
Oh.
In the documentary Free for All, there is a moment where you hear James Baldwin, the author's mm-hmm. voice, and he is talking about his visits to the library and how he went at least 3 times a week, and he read everything that they had, every single book. And he says, I read books like they were some weird kind of food. And he goes on and talks about what he was listening to or what he was looking for in the pages of those books. And then he says this, you think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. It was books that taught me. The things that tormented me the most were the very things that connected me to all people who were alive, who had ever been alive. Common humanity.
I think it's good to just sit with that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, great.
James Baldwin.
Of course.
And they had his actual voice reading it, so I'm always going back and listened again and again to that. And you know, we have this sense that our suffering is somehow unique, and it is because it's us having it. But when we tap into that common humanity, which we don't have to do it by suffering, right? We can also do it by reading. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We realize what it means to be human and be hungry or mm-hmm. lonely or to fail or to have things outside of our control.
Yeah.
And that connects us.
I'm going to go back to my favorite book and my favorite character in all of American literature.
Yeah.
The Scarlet Letter.
Oh, yeah.
Hester Prynne. Yeah. The book says she was wasted, wounded, and wronged. But what did she do? She returned to her community that hurt her so badly, and she helped other women who had been wasted, wounded, and wronged. She took the pain in her life, she took the hardship, and she turned it into good.
Wow.
She connected. She showed compassion.
Elliot Rosewater, and God bless you, Mr. Rosewater, by Kurt Vonnegut. And he's just the hapless, but he's wealthy, he has all this money, and the whole book, I don't want to give away the ending if you haven't read it, but is this whole quest to return this ill-gotten wealth to people, to human beings. And he stumbles and falls, and he's unloved, and his father's trying to take his inheritance away from him because he's, you know, not worthy. He is not worthy of being a Rosewater. And yet, in the end, you know, he finds a way to say you are all worthy.
He connects.
You're all worthy of wealth, of this distribution of my wealth. Wow. And that book touched me my whole life. Yeah. Mm. Jackie, you have a character that comes to mind?
No, yes, countless, of course. Right. But I think I'm thinking about you, Gina, and your example that you just gave about feeling self-critical, about needing more rest this time of year, and the words that you're using towards yourself in relationship mm-hmm. to that feeling. And I almost interrupted and said, oh, Gina, you're adjunct professor at multiple universities this semester, and you're teaching more than one prep, and you're a mother of two, and you mm-hmm. pick up the phone whenever I call, and you do that for countless other people. Like, of course you're exhausted. Like, mm-hmm. you probably need a nap more than anybody I know, right? Mm-hmm. And so my innate reaction to talk to Gina, who's my very good friend, with this, like, just to say, validate the experience she's going through and say, of course you're feeling that way, that makes so much sense to me, is if you can turn that towards yourself, if you can talk to yourself the way you would talk to a really good friend, mm-hmm. yeah. that is the practice of self-compassion.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to do towards Gina because that's, I care about her so much. It's so much harder to flip it around and do it to oneself.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key that, for at least I think most educators I know, so we know how to do that for students, and we know how to do that for people in need. And so because you can do it for other people, you can do it for yourself.
Mm. Yeah. Start with the
Well, you mentioned, I mean, and Dr. Neff talks in her talk about warmth, gentle touch, and soft vocalization. We're mammals, after all. Mm. So curling up in a blanket and, you know, holding your hands around a cup of hot cocoa. Oh,
that's
you're a mammal right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the comfort of being, you're not a reptile. Mm-hmm. You have parts of your brain that respond to those threats, mm-hmm. but these are the parts of your brain that sort of deeply are restful. And so you already know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to yourself like you would a good friend. Find some warmth, find some comfort, find some rest. But it's not easy to do always.
Yeah, there's the society culture, I don't know, that is always do more, be more, produce. And that's what we're battling, right?
Yeah.
But I will say this, that here's some great hope. And, you know, we're three women who are aging. And I think with every decade, it probably starts in middle school where I was most critical of myself.
Yeah.
And it lessens with every decade, I think. But it was hardest to find rest and to find self-compassion when I was younger and trying to achieve. I was striving, trying to find my place in this world. And now that I am in my upper 40s, I can tell that I have more self-compassion by and large because I've been through all of that. I did find my place. And I've gained more confidence with every decade. I actually love aging.
Yeah.
I love it.
I was shockingly good at this in my 20s.
You were shockingly what?
Good at that self-compassion and slowing down. And I think part of it was geography. Since I was in the Marines, I lived in Hawaii.
Okay.
And so you're by the beach, and the beach was just it was a constant. I went to the beach every morning. I went to the beach after work. I sat by the ocean a lot. So I had this very natural, I did a lot of reading. And you had these very, very intense responsibilities in the military, and then you had nothing.
Mm.
And so I was able to turn the nothing into beach, books, rest. And since I was a woman, I was isolated a lot, which as an introvert was just fine for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to turn that into a sort of self-compassion thing. So I was actually pretty good in my 20s.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a great story to tell people.
Yeah. Jackie, mm-hmm. do you feel like I feel where it's gotten better with each decade, or do you feel like Lori where it's can be kind of random?
I think environmental, if I put myself in, that was a situation.
Mm.
So for me, it's like certain things.
The
like
context.
So winter, it's a little harder for me to get out.
Yeah.
And, you know, be in nature because it's cold and I don't want to be out in nature. Nature hurts right now.
It does,
and so, but I'm better at this when I have when I have access to natural spaces.
Okay.
That makes so much sense.
And so that was, you know, it's always a good reminder. Like, this will be easier for you to do when it's spring. Jackie, what were you going to say there? Sorry.
Oh, no. I was glad you shared all of that. I think for me, self-compassion is always a challenge. And I do feel as though I'm better at it now than I maybe ever have been. But I think that's only true because I've put a lot of effort into self-compassion. So I don't think if I had read all of this and done these practices and thought about it this much that it would have come very naturally to me.
Yeah, it's a learned skill.
It very much has been a learned skill.
And you can learn it and you can teach it.
Yep.
To your students, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can teach them self-compassion. You can help them learn the skill.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. How to respond to feedback, for instance.
Mm.
How to respond when you...
What do you mean?
Well, when a teacher gives a student feedback about their writing or whatever they've done in school, then does the student automatically curl up and feel like a failure or have that growth mindset? It comes back to growth mindset, doesn't it?
Like, that compassionate, like giving the feedback.
And being a warm demander, I guess you could say, as well, instead of being a critical judge, being that mentor.
Yeah,
to the student.
Right. And knowing, like you said, Jackie, the student is going to respond with curiosity and motivation more if you're compassionate than if you come in shouting and, you know, saying, boy, you really blew it on that test. Mm-hmm. You all, you know, I'm thinking of the movie The Holdovers where
great movie.
The teachers.
He says these really linguistically intricate ways to insult his students. And coincidentally, none of them are doing very well in the class.
Right, right.
Which might be connected.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. I want to know how each of you, what's your most common or effective way to show yourself self-compassion and to recharge and rest?
I think for me, rest is really important, and regular reminders of the importance of rest. I have to regularly tell myself I am not a machine. I am a person. Yeah. And therefore, I need sleep. I need to breathe well. I need to exercise. I need water. And I need proper nutrition. And for whatever reason, I continuously think, maybe I don't need those things.
Maybe I am the exception to the rule.
Maybe I don't have to have those things. Yeah. And so I have to put that as a regular reminder to myself. And I think that educators are, I don't want to say we're unique. I think everyone struggles with this, but there's something about the way that the day is structured where you have to be very deliberate about taking care of those physical needs in order to stay in a place of self-compassion and stay charged up. But then the second piece of how I practice self-compassion is that I watch myself do it for other people easily. And then I say, look, you can do that for other people and therefore you can do it for yourself. Yeah. And so, I have to do that kind of mental gymnastics, I guess, to help myself stay self-compassionate.
I think for me, it's reading, it's books, it's, you know, writing, obviously. You know, watching the TED Talk and taking notes on it slowly and deliberately, you know, just again, it's a grounding for me, probably books, literature, you know, so I would say nature, but we've covered that right now. No, thank you. But then I will go home and pick up a book and read slow reading.
You've said the word slow 3 or 4 times. Yeah. I think that's the key to it.
I'm a slow
down
person.
I mean, there's research that shows that reading like an e-book versus reading a book on paper, you usually take in more when it's the book on paper because you tend to slow down.
Yeah,
slow, that's me. Slow is important.
I'm a slow person.
And I love that about you.
In a fast world.
Yeah.
Especially as a journalist.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But look at the kind of journalism I do.
True.
I do slow journalism.
Have you read anything about the slow librarianship movement?
What? No.
Oh, I really got into that when I was a librarian.
Tell us more.
I'm writing that down. Yes.
So it stems from the slow food movement, right?
Yeah.
As a counter to fast food, slow food.
Yeah.
So that's the origin of it. And then it's been extended to what you're talking about with slow journalism. But librarianship argues in favor of going slowly, that it's one of the or at least this concept of librarianship argues in favor of going slowly because it's one of the few places that exist in our society that is intentionally slow. And there are many reasons, just like there is in the slow food movement, of why it's better for you on a nutritional level and on a mental level and a physical level to eat food that has been cultivated slowly and cook slowly and to eat it slowly. That's true for reading and just being in a space that moves at a slower pace. So we were conscientious of not over scheduling programming or not having programming move at a pace that was too fast or not trying to push patrons through things too quickly in the name of that theory.
You can find this episode and more on SDPB's Teacher Talk. It's a podcast that celebrates teachers and education. Find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform and find the companion blogs on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.